Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program I explore the leading edge of science, art, consciousness, and where we're going as a planetary race. Tonight I have someone who I'm very excited about talking to because he's involved in the fields that I'm most interested in, art and science, and he's a real expert in both of them. He's Edward Balbruno. Thank you, Ed, for being here tonight.
Thank you.
I would say you're most established as a scientist, right? That's really, I mean, even though you're a real expert, you're a beautiful artist. Let's talk about your science career, because. I think that you've made some important discoveries, and why don't we just talk about that in a sense? Like, how did you get, started as a scientist, and you really reached a very proficient level? What got you into the sciences in the first place?
Basically, I've always been into space. As a four-year-old kid, I was fascinated by space, and I like going back to my art. At 7 years old, I painted a view of Saturn from the moon of Titan. So it's been in my blood to be in the space, you know, all interested in that. So when I went off to college, I was actually a chemistry major, and I was interested in astrochemistry because it was a field dealing with life in space. And then when I went on in that, I got interested in math. I was good at it. But then I gravitated towards, mathematics as it relates to space, and that got me into the field of celestial mechanics.
Celestial mechanics. So, and then in the celestial mechanics field, you made some important discoveries.
Yeah, I did. I got my doctorate from NYU, back in the dark ages in 1981. And I was a professor for a few years at Boston University in math, but I was doing theoretical work. I got bored with it, so I went to work for NASA out in Pasadena at the Jet Propulsion Lab, which sends all these robotic missions all over the solar system to Mars and all this. And I was hired at the time to do trajectory design for the Galileo mission to Jupiter and the current Cassini mission, which is now at Saturn. I noticed that when they send spacecraft, for example, to the moon, they get there like in 3 days, but when you get to the moon in 3 days, you have to put your brakes on, which means you fire your retro rockets, and at $1 million a pound, you can burn maybe 100 pounds of fuel to go into orbit for a small robotic mission, so it costs you like $100 million just to slow down to go around the moon. So I asked naively at the time when I arrived there in 1986, because there was a bunch of engineers, and I was trained as a mathematician. I asked them, well, can't you get to the moon and go into orbit automatically using the chaos between the subtle gravity of the moon pulling in and the Earth pulling out and the sun pulling out? And they said, you could never do that. No one's ever done it before. You're certainly not doing it. In fact, they told me, you weren't even trained in engineering for this kind of field. Any event, I saw it as a red flag when they said that, and I went into it, and I did find a way to get to the moon for free. It took 2 years as opposed to 3 days, but I did find a way to do it in 1987, and it was viewed as somewhat of a big deal. But then it was a whole new approach to the field. No one understood what was going on, and I didn't either, but it worked. It allowed spaceships. Yes?
No, I'm just interested in this idea of chaos theory that you sort of discovered. I mean, there's many different views of chaos theory. What did you mean as far as chaos theory? Because can you explain that a little bit in more detail?
Yeah. Basically, chaos for the for people, it's a term used all the time, but in the math sense of it, it sort of means that if you make a tiny change in the beginning of a trajectory of something, you get wildly complicated resulting pathway. So, for example, on Earth, if you have a leaf falling through the air on a autumn day, it'll dart all over the place with the wind blowing, and you really don't even know where it's going. If you had too much to drink on a Friday night, you know, a little bit of a push either way can make you stagger all over the place. That's called drunkard's walk, you know. So
right.
That's a chaotic process. Now, the way I use chaos is if you can imagine the moon's got gravity pulling in, and the Earth, if you're at the moon, the Earth is really a big body pulling you away. So there's going to be a place where the gravity's balanced, and it's sort of like a surfer catching a wave. The surfer paddles out in the surfboard, and he tries to ride the crest of the wave, and he stands up, and it's a very chaotic process doing that. So in this case, you have the gravity between the Earth and the moon balancing. It's like a surfer catching a gravity wave in this case. So you want the spaceship to come in, and it rides its balancing place between the Earth and moon, and by doing that, it can go around the moon for free.
Well, I see. So there's a point where the Earth's energy is not strong and the moon's energy. It's sort of like a free place where the gravity, even though the moon's gravity is much less than the Earth because of its mass, it's probably a place much closer to the moon then, right?
It's about 50,000 miles from the moon. So it's still fairly close because the moon's about 250,000 miles away. So it's relatively close to the moon. Now, but it's not just a point. It's an entire region around the moon itself.
So in that point, that if you could ride that middle point between the Earth's gravity and the moon's gravity, what is it that propels an object in between those two gravitational points?
Well, when you arrive at this location you're talking about, you're not arriving at rest between them. You're actually moving, so you have a little momentum behind you. So basically, it's not just a place where the gravity balances when you're fixed relative to the two objects, but as you're moving. So it's a big region around the moon where, as you're moving in it, it's constantly changing. But as it's changing, the gravity nevertheless balances between the Earth and the moon. So it's a huge area, and it's sort of the same idea of riding a wave.
I see. Do you actually understand what gravity is? Because no one seems to really know.
No. To do all this stuff, even though it's incredibly complicated and there's chaos involved like I just described, it's really, we're just using gravity model as a standard way people learned it in high school now, is the inverse square force law from Newton back in the 1600s, and that's all this is. So we have no understanding of it. We can model what the force is by that little formula, but what it is, it's not really not necessary to do this.
Right, but what do you think? I mean, if we can be a little philosophical, I mean, what do you actually think gravity is? I know Einstein has his theories, but what do you say, even using some of that creative talent that you have, what would you make up if you could make up an idea of how it works and what it is?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not a physicist. I'm really a space mathematician. But if I had to take a wild guess what gravity is, what Einstein said it was the warping of space due to a massive object being there. But that really, to me, is not really describing what it is. It's probably, I mean, I don't know. I would probably guess that it's that matter itself creates an imbalance with the vacuum that we call the vacuum of space. It's sort of an imbalance between those two things, and the mass being there throws things out of a static equilibrium, and it causes a flow to occur in space and time. And what that flow is really not understood, but it does create some kind of flow.
Huh. Do you know the work of Nassim Harmim and his black hole theory?
No.
Oh, you might want to check that out. He has a website called Crossing the Event Horizon, where he talks a lot about the physics of black holes, and he says it, he's actually attempting to generate mini black holes for propulsion. And
well, that sounds really, really cool. I'll check that out.
Check it out. I'd be very curious to get you two together because I think he could really be the next Einstein. I've interviewed him. And he's on to something, I think. So you
What's
have
his last
this
name?
Haramim, H-A-R-R-E-I-M, Haramim.
Okay.
Go to the resonanceproject.org and there's a bunch of videos on Google Video where he talks about his theories. And actually, he involves a lot of math. So if you're a mathematician,
mm-hmm.
then you will really appreciate some of his work about the mass of the proton he also goes into. And he's saying basically quantum physics is really just a fudge principle for making up answers to things they can't explain. He says Einstein was much closer to the truth, but then does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, basically classical physics breaks down when you try to understand quantum mechanics because it just works totally different from what we're used to. So we have no language for it. Our laws of physics are based on, if you really look at it carefully, it's based on some very basic laws of math. You know, you got like the distributive law, the commutative law, and there's like, I don't know, there's like a bunch of laws of math, maybe six or seven or eight, I forget the number. But everything is based on that. But when you go to quantum mechanics, those aren't valid anymore. So what they've done is they've made up a language to try to make sense of it, which is quantum mechanics. But it's just the language, really.
But does it make sense of it or not really?
In part it does. I mean, I think there's some basic things in quantum mechanics which are very strange, like called quantum entanglement and some other things, where the quantum mechanics as we've devised it more or less understands those kind of things. But from what I understand, there's this other phenomenon in quantum mechanics that the current setup does not explain.
What's that?
Those are things that I'm really not well versed in. I've just read about these in popular science magazines and things.
But what doesn't quantum mechanics explain that you've read?
The whole idea of this thing called the Planck distance. Max Planck, of course, was a German physicist who was one of the founders of quantum mechanics. And he came up with a distance. It's an incredibly small distance, and I don't have the number right off to be exact.
Right, yeah.
But if you go within that distance, then our laws of physics are no longer valid. But more interestingly, subatomic particles will come out of nowhere, and they'll go into nowhere. So they're created out of nothing, and they go into nothing. And they call them virtual particles, but basically, it goes against our laws of physics, which says you can't create something out of nothing. But yet, that does occur, and there's no understanding of this.
Well, it seems, though, like, in a way, everything, I mean, the Taoists, the Chinese, say everything has been created from nothing. So, in a way, it's the most basic law of the universe.
I guess in that sense, you're probably right. In terms of physics, as we understand it, as we're doing it, we have the law of conservation of energy. Energy can, you know, can't be, in other words, if you put energy in, something's got to come out. If something is coming out of nowhere, then that balance of the law of conservation of energy appears to be violated.
But is the universe an open system or is it a closed system?
That's a good question.
Because if it's an open system, then there's really no such thing as entropy, right? If it's a closed system, then entropy applies.
Absolutely. And I guess that's a really good point. And I guess at this point right now, we don't know if it's open or closed. It's sort of one of the outstanding questions in cosmology.
Well, you know what cosmologists don't explain is this whole thing of consciousness, which I think quantum physicists are trying to get a handle on how an experiment would change if someone observes it. Is that something, or is that just more pop physics, really?
That appears to be something which has actually been experimentally verified, and I guess that was done in the 90s. They at MIT, I think, where an experiment was run that really verified that whether or not an observer is looking at an experiment does it affect the outcome.
So that means that consciousness or the act of observation, has power. There's something about who we are as conscious beings that must be intricately connected to the rest of the universe, it seems.
Yeah, it would seem so. I mean, that would seem so. Like, as you probably know, the famous Bell's theorem, that everything is connected. So Einstein thought that couldn't be true, but Bell proved using his famous Bell inequality that you could have two particles. One could be here, or one could be in the next galaxy, and if one moves here, it will move there. But that violates Einstein's theory of the fact that the speed of light is as fast as you can go. This would be instantaneous; would be far faster than that.
Because I think we're missing a dimension, because they, in a sense, this is my theory, that they seem to actually still be connected. There's really no distance between the two. Einstein's right about distance, but if we just see that, it only appears as if they're separate.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
I mean, are there people, are you coming up with more science to explain this, and how do you fit this whole idea of consciousness into science? Is there room for it?
Well, you're asking really good questions. I mean,
take a guess. There's no right answer, of course.
Yeah. As Carl Sagan said before he passed away, if you truly want to understand the universe and how it operates, you need to understand the human mind. And I agree. I mean, it's so hard to answer. I mean, at least in my own life, I've experienced things with my conscience, with my own mind that goes against everything that I've ever learned, which tells me that there's an interrelation between our minds and the universe, which transcends what we think reality really is. So,
I'm curious about those things that happen to you that go against the logics of science. Do you mind if you share a few of your personal experiences?
Oh, I can do that. Absolutely, yes. Well, there's many of them. In fact, there's some I prefer not to talk about on this. But
of course,
there is something though I could share that happened to me several times actually, and blew me away because this was back in the early 90s, about 93, and I was at a party in Minnesota with my girlfriend at the time, and the person holding the party was a friend of mine. I just met her, and she told me there was some person I had to meet, and the woman's name was Moonstar, and with my background, of course, being space and math and celestial mechanics and space, I had to meet this woman, the Moonstar, and it seemed like I really couldn't meet her. Every time there was an opportunity to meet her, something would happen. So it was as if the universe was playing tricks on me that I just couldn't meet the person. So finally, there was a party going on, and I was told that she was going to be there. So I show up with my girlfriend at the time, and there's a receiving line there, and I notice at the end of the line there was this woman with jet black hair. She was a very striking looking woman from what I could tell briefly, but she was still far away, and it was like I still couldn't see her, even though I'm going to this party. So it was like this person was always out of reach. So I said, finally, there's someone there. It must be her. I can't wait to meet her. So I get to the end of the line and finally go face to face with her, And the moment I saw her face to face, I heard in my ears a screeching sound, and all around her were sharp black lines all around her, and they flashed and went away, and as they flashed, I heard a screeching sound. And I said to my date, "Did you see that? There's black lines all around that person." And she goes, "Well, I didn't see anything," but she looked startled as well. And it was such a strong image I had. And the noise was so loud that I had to shake it off. And I said, "Let's get away from her and filter on the party." And all night I was saying, "What the heck? What happened there?" So that night, so I left, and I didn't even talk to her. I was afraid to talk to her after that. So I left the party because there were a lot of people there with this woman. We went home and went to bed. And then in the morning at 7 o'clock, the phone rings. And when the phone rang, it was someone announcing that woman, Moonstar, had passed away at about 4 o'clock in the morning in a car accident.
Wow.
It occurred to me that the screeching noise must have been the car accident.
So you saw the future there.
I saw the future, and the black lines was a way that the universe was showing me that she was being cut out of reality.
Do you think it could have been prevented if you were more, I mean, not that it was your responsibility, but you think we can control destiny because you were shown something? I mean, you think something like that?
Well, this has happened to me several times since, and when it does, it happens so quickly, I never have enough time to do anything. But a friend of mine who knows, in fact, the woman who invited me to her house that night, who knows about this, she said to me, "If you ever see this happen, don't ever tell the person. You just don't want to do that."
I think it's being shown sometimes because it's not always set in stone. I think, you know, that's my belief.
Yes.
But still, there's no science that can explain this, is there?
No, and myself being a hardcore mathematician and scientist, when that happened, and when it happened like two or three other times, years later, and under very unusual circumstances, it's clear to me it's real, it's repeatable, it's happened a number of times, it satisfies all the criteria of a consistent phenomenon, and obviously that does not fit any theory that I've ever seen in the sciences, so... it tells me that our conscious, like you were saying, our conscious mind does indeed have the ability to see into the future. And moreover, in my case, when people are going to pass away.
Right. So is there any good instances that it happened with you?
Any what?
Is there any good instances where, you know, you've had seen the future and it was a positive type of effect?
No, for me personally, the only times I've ever been able to see into the future is this kind of thing here with these black lines.
Right, and you saw black lines these other times as well, huh?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, you actually met a time traveler. I got your number, Vika. What do you think of the whole, and what's the physics of time travel if you look at the math and all that? Is something like that actually possible?
Well, I met someone who, you know, John Anderson.
Yeah,
once.
David Anderson, I think.
What?
I thought his name was David Anderson.
Yeah,
right?
David. Yeah, David. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
Someone else I know, John. No, yeah, David Anderson. There's a colleague of mine at Princeton. His name is Richard Gott, G-O-T-T, and he wrote a book called Time Travel.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, actually, some of his work was just on PBS when they were talking about this topic. And he showed that, in fact, if you look at Einstein's theory of general relativity, which says that if you get near a highly massive object like a star, time will slow down, it'll go forward, it'll go backwards. And he showed that under weird circumstances, using string theory, that there is a way to actually make a time machine, but it would require manipulating objects the size of Jupiter and huge structures, you know, thousands and thousands of miles long. So it's not really feasible to do.
Well, but, no, I think that to use those objects for the energy, but if there was a way to get access to energy without using such huge objects, it might be possible, right?
If you could get access to the energies that Richard Gott was talking about without using these large objects, then yes, you could then set up a scenario where time travel would be possible. Absolutely.
I mean, maybe there's something going on in our brains that it allows us to time travel. Maybe that was what those psychic experiences were. They were actually time travel moments. I mean, I'm just throwing it out there, but
as you probably know, and you've talked to many guests about this, it's by my personal belief that our minds, of course, are connected in the Jungian sense to a deeper reality which doesn't even know time. Time is not even there, and if you can tap into that, then there's no sense of past or future. Everything is sort of one. And in that sense, you're going to have access to both the past and the future, and there's no distinguishing of them at all. And perhaps one has the ability at times to tap into that with your mind, and then you can see things.
Well, what I don't get about time travel, I know this is sort of out of your field, but time seems so subjective. It's like, I don't think it can even be shared with, I mean, of course we shared a time, but it seems like it's a very personal experience, and I don't know how there could be an objective formula for something that's so subjective.
Yeah, that's a really good point, too. I mean, I'm sure a tree, for example, is not watching the time, and a rock certainly doesn't care about the time, so... Yeah, time could be, I guess what you're suggesting, time could be purely a human invented thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think David Anderson, if he did it, actually did his time travel?
I don't know. I've heard about his, I've heard that he has a way to do this. However, it is not a way which has been published in any journal or presented to the scientific community, as far as I know. So nobody knows at this point.
I mean, what are the big mysteries left in science? I mean, there seems to be a lot, you know.
Well, you certainly mentioned some good ones there. The biggest one confronting us right now, which is called the missing matter problem, where currently we don't know where most of the mass of the universe is.
Well, actually, this guy Nassim solves that problem by re-explaining or reconfiguring the weight of the proton. He says,
"Really?
Yes." He actually wrote a paper. I'll send you his paper. I think it's on his website, the Resonance Project. And he says it's the whole thing has to do with spin and torque and this reconfiguration of the actual mass of the proton. So.
Really?
He says nothing's missing, but according to his calculations.
Interesting. Yeah, I got to check. Yeah, I guess you have to send that to me. That sounds really interesting.
I'd love to have your analysis of it actually as well, because I'm not trained in that, and if you could do that, maybe we could do a show with Nassim, because he's been my guest about what you find in that paper. So I'll do that, and you can give me some feedback about that. But what were you saying?
Yeah, well, I'm just saying if we don't mention his name and the fact he may have a solution, because it's certainly not something which is published today it's not accepted, because they say today there is no solution. So I guess he would have some work to do to present his work and get it accepted. But currently, we don't know what most of the matter is, so that to me is a huge problem.
Well, another theory, and this is my theory, could it be that all the matter that we're really seeing is as if we're looking at the surface of a lake, and there's a depth there, but all we're seeing is the top layer of what exists? I mean,
could be. It could be that our perceptions are just... that's a good point. It could be that our perceptions are just not developed enough to see anything more in the reality than we can see right now. It'd just sort of be like asking an ant, you know, to understand quantum mechanics. It's just not there yet, you know. And likewise, we may not be even there yet to understand these questions.
Oh, we're absolutely not there. I mean, there's so much we have yet to discover. That's the arrogance. That's what bothers people about science. They keep thinking they have the answers until they realize that they don't. You know, there was that story in the 1890s how they were going to close the patent office because they felt there was nothing else to invent.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and certainly myself being in the work that I do in celestial mechanics, you know, and in the science industry, and actually I've been applying it to spacecraft motion, and in the origin of the moon and things like that. You know, we have no problem saying that we don't understand these problems. They're way too complicated, but I think there is a sense of, and I don't mean to be singling out the physics community, but there are a number of physicists who really, I think, like to be a little bit thinking that we know a bit more than what we do. In my opinion, we know very, very little, if anything. We just scratch the surface.
Right. I mean, Samuel Butler, who was a kind of philosopher, said that science is man's ignorance of man's ignorance. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
So we're really in the beginning of understanding, you know, really the nature of reality. And what do you think about the whole UFO phenomena as a physicist? I mean, do you think it's real? Do you think something's there?
Well, this gets into a can of worms, which I really don't want to get into, but I can say without a doubt that it is real.
Okay, that gives us a little clue about, yeah. So if
there's absolutely no question about that.
Well, then it doesn't seem any question to me. But yet, the scientists, first of all, they say it's impossible, and then they go about living in a very narrow box about not even being open to that information, and that somehow, I feel that has to change. I mean, I think, you know, people like you and others, this is just my personal opinion, do need to come forward and say, hey, guys, you're looking at the wrong thing. This thing does exist. It would change our world so much for the better. I don't know why there's such a stigmatism against acknowledging that. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I think part of it is that the scientific method is based on the reproducibility of things, and you want to be able to reproduce something at will, and then if you can reproduce it, it's valid. That's just a scientific method. And people are just trained in that. So if somebody has an experience where they're actually confronted with one of these things a few feet away, and they're actually communicating with things a few feet away, and they can see them, and it's real, and there's no question about it, that's a subjective experience. So to convince the scientific community of this, you'd have to have them come back at another time at your own will and talk with them. But the problem is they have their own ideas.
Right. And you know what? I think this is what I'm kind of moving towards, and what I'm doing is that the new paradigm is actually based on subjective experience. I think objective reality has only gotten us so far, and you know, it now has reached its limits, and we have to bring into even scientific inquiry. I think this is what we were saying about consciousness and the quantum theory, is that somehow the subjective reality must be acknowledged.
Yeah, you know, it's a theory, it's an idea of mine that these UFO, I don't really use that term,
yeah,
seeing entities which are living things or vehicles that they're moving with, they don't necessarily have to be from outer space. They could be simply from another dimension. And we see them because our mind is connected to this place, you know, where reality is one, and which people meditate, they could sometimes go there. But I think these things reside there. And at times, one may get a glimpse of that, and they think they're seeing something from another place, but it could be just from here, just from another dimension.
I agree. Well, is there any scientific basis to this interdimensional theory? I mean, I know there's 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions, string theory.
String theory, right.
Right, but is there anything in terms of perceivability or something that we can relate to as it intersecting with our reality? No, there isn't.
In fact, that's one of the problems with string theory, is that it comes up with like 11 dimensions to explain things, but they've never seen these dimensions. So there's no proof of that. However, this Large Hadron Collider in CERN, in Switzerland, which is going to be able to go to ultimately 7 trillion electron volts, they claim that that will be at such high energy that it would expose other dimensions.
Right, right. And they say that it's being sabotaged by the future. That's why it's not working. Have you heard that one?
No.
That was some silly, it was sort of a silly article, but they said if it was to work, it would, create some weird warp in time, and so the future is sabotaging it for it not to work. But getting back to this understanding of reality, I think this is where your art comes in, because I liked what you said about your art, and Ed's a great artist. If you go to his website, is what's your website again?
It's simply edbelbruno.com.
That's B-E-L-B-R-U-N-O, and you're a very amazing artist, and I like your opening art statement where you say, "My paintings strive to reflect a sense of a higher reality, which is not solely based on what is visible, but includes aspects of that are unperceivable to the naked eye, frequently involved futurists." Anyway, this is like a whole, this doesn't relate at all to what you call the scientific method.
No, it doesn't. I'm very lucky to have a talent in art as well as the science, but when I do the art, I do it, I have to switch off my logical mind and go to that, and that's a mind where I just channel the universe, so to speak, whatever that is, and it gives a much deeper sense of what's going on.
But I think the artists and the scientists both have that something in their imagination in common. I mean, to be a theoretical scientist, or even to do what you do, there's something of the creative imagination. Even in your chaos theory, Fly Me to the Moon understanding, there was a creative insight that allowed a door to open up. So,
yes, that's right. Well, the day I made the discovery on the new route to the moon using chaos theory happened in the moment where I let go of a lot of fear and anger towards the situation I was in at my job. And the moment I let go of that's when I had the discovery.
Right. So I think the artist and the scientist both perceive these realities that don't exist yet. I mean, you saw something that, you felt was possible but wasn't a reality. But I think that's the role, that's the commonality of art and science, is to perceive these new realities, as I call them.
Yeah, but now there's a real, to me, the art is much deeper, because like when I've been lucky enough to make a scientific discovery, the moment that happens, it takes maybe a nanosecond, and then I'll get the insight and make a discovery. However, when you're really in the zone, so to speak, doing a painting, you're in that zone, not just for a nanosecond, but you're in it for hours. So you're accessing this place for hours at a time, and it's a much more it's a much deeper experience.
Huh. Well, what is that place, and how does and doesn't the ideas of the imagination come from nowhere? We talked earlier about you saying the laws of physics say that you can't create something from nothing, but yet it seems like the artist's imagination, something is actually being created from nothing.
Yeah, I mean, that's That's a really good point. Yeah, I mean, they're not dreams. I had a period in my life, and I still have recently, where I'll wake up at like 3 or 4 in the morning. I open my eyes up. I don't see the room. I see like someone's taking a pair of scissors and cut out a view in where the room should be, and instead of that is a panorama of another place. And it's like I can see it in real time. It's beautiful. It's got mountain ranges and everything else going on. And I feel that what I'm looking into is this place.
It's a real place, you feel?
It's a real place, yeah.
And it exists on a different dimension?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm totally convinced of that.
Well, you know, you're a mystic. That's what you really are. And I think it's time that scientists like you come forward and say there is this reality that exists, but yes, it's subjective, but we, like, you know, it was the quest for flight among you for thousands of years. Men thought they should fly, and suddenly someone came along and proved it was possible. But it's the same thing with discovering these mystical realities. There, I know they're real too.
Yeah. So I don't see any way to prove it. So the way I'm doing it is I paint it. And if you go to my website, edbelbruno.com, somebody wrote an art book about my art. Her name is Talia Page, and she entitled the book Belbruno's Universe, but there's a digital copy of the book there. And if you look at that, I think it gives you a sense of what this place is.
Well, it would be provable if two people saw the same thing.
It would be, and I have met people like, if you look at my paintings in that book or at my site, there's a bunch of paintings I did early on, and it's a jet black sky with pinpoint stars and these beautiful mountain ranges, and it's clearly a place. That's the place. And in my art book, they're called the Black Knight paintings. And I have met people who have seen them, and they say, you know, I've seen the same place.
So what does it have to take? I mean, you're on the inside. What does it have to take for science to shift its paradigm and acknowledge, let's say, the impossible, or what could be possible at this point? You know what I'm asking? We're so stuck, and you know, people like you come along and make new discoveries, but basically they're sort of stuck. They're stuck in an old way based on the scientific method. Something has to shift in order to make new discoveries and break out of the box. What do you think it is?
I don't know. I mean, this stuff, like you're saying, is very subjective. Each person has their own way. I mean, not each person. Some people have a way to access it. For example, Thomas Edison, I don't know if you know this or not, but the way he made his discoveries is he would take a nap like every day at a certain time, and he would just nod out. And when he nodded out, or when he meditated, he nodded out as well, I forget how it worked, but he had like bells put on, he put like bell on his arm, and when he nodded out, his arm would drop and the bell would wake him up. And that moment you wake up is when you have the images. And he did this when he was meditating. When he had those images for those brief moments, which where he's in this trance state of presumably this other dimension, that's when he saw his discoveries. So he was actually making use of it, doing that. This understanding of this place, how to access it, is probably the key. Work has to be done to understand how is it you can meditate, or how is it you can have a glimpse of this other place. And I have a procedure for it that people can follow. Right now, there is no procedure. I mean, you can meditate and sort of get cool experiences. But if you want to make solid scientific discoveries by utilizing it, you have to be super, super lucky, like I was once with that route to the moon discovery. Edison definitely made use of it, and I'm sure other people have too. But I don't know of a book or any place you can go to which says, here's a recipe for doing this.
Well, we do have to start to acknowledge states of consciousness, it seems like. And William James was very much into that. You know, he coined the word stream of consciousness, but he also said there's many different realities that separate us from this world. So there, I think you're onto something, and even your psychic experiences, if you want to call it that, show that reality exists in a sort of level of consciousness that we're inhabiting, and as we shift consciousness, new worlds assemble. Like, this is the sort of mystical philosophy.
And it's such a shame because the scientific method, which has come about since the Middle Ages in a really strong way, just doesn't want to deal with that because it doesn't satisfy the laws of deductive reasoning, which is very, very, very restrictive.
Right. So what has to change in order for scientists to acknowledge that maybe there's other ways of knowing, as like Carlos Castaneda said?
Well, for example, we were talking about before, and you're asking about quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
I think, and also the dark matter theory, these theories are going to be seen by the general community people are just going to go up against a brick wall where suddenly everything's going to be on its head trying to understand it. And I think people will be forced into looking at bizarre ways to understand these problems.
Right. I think it's so important that people like you are involved in science because at least you have that awareness, you know, and you seems like you trust it based on those pretty intense experiences that you've had. I would say whatever's been downloaded to you and you're in that field is there because you're making a contribution on that level of consciousness to science.
That's, yeah, now, for anyone out there who might be, you know me, I have to say, when I do my scientific work, I do the standard work. I'm not doing these methods. I mean, if I'm proving a theorem in math or doing computer work for a route in space, I'm using the standard techniques that we have today for that.
Right, but what we're saying here, that presents a limitation if we're going to go further.
Yeah, if we're going to go further, you asked the perfect question. How is it that, you know, people can start to be more accepting of these other ways that we've talked about? But these other ways, I don't think are that common. I mean, a few people have experienced them, but I don't think it's so common that everyone can say, "Hey, I've had that experience too." I think it's rare, and it's relatively rare. So. I think one way it'll be more accepted is if more and more people sort of have these experiences, but you have to be open to it to begin with.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. I know what this conversation isn't based on. You know, this is a philosophical conversation. I know you're a very academic, mainstream scientist, and your work is in that field. But as far as philosophy, I think we can philosophize about the fact that experience, I think people have had this experience, and I think as it becomes more talked about, it's people will notice it more. I mean, there's lots of examples of that. It's like if something isn't articulated, it goes unconscious. I mean, people don't notice it, but when it's pointed out. And I think that's really my mission with New Realities, is to point out that there are these other realities. And when it's pointed out, especially by people in some level of authority, it's like, even though it's separate from your work, it's like people can then realize what's been articulated or what's been noticed. You know, it's like an expert musician listening to, you know, a symphony as opposed to just a lay person. They hear something different, but when it's pointed out, did you hear that sound, then other people can notice. So I think people exploring the edge of reality when certain experiences are acknowledged, it opens the door for other people to realize that those things are possible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, in one way, actually, I am doing it in one sense. A lot of my art recently has to do with painting the microwave background radiation from the Big Bang of the universe. And I have access to, like everyone else does, to the WMAP satellite's picture of the microwave radiation as it occurred very close to the Big Bang, and they can map it out. And I did a painting of that 2 years ago, and I was so turned on by it. It looked like an abstract expressionist painting. I said, let me paint other things with microwaves, not necessarily the microwave but itself, but let me paint people as microwaves, other things as microwaves. And I've done a whole set of paintings with these, and people are just fascinated by them because it's pointing, showing a level of reality which you'll never see, but yet it's there. In fact, a bunch of my microwave paintings, which some of them are not even based on the microwave radiation of the universe, are hanging up at Princeton University's astrophysics department, where a lot of this work goes on, because they see the connection that these paintings, although they're not scientific paintings, they do have the essence or the sense of the true scientific work that's being done with microwaves. So a connection's been made in that sense, which I think is pretty valuable.
Well, I think that's very important. I mean, I think that's actually the value of art, is to, like you said in your statement, to perceive the unperceivable. But by doing that, and this is something I'm writing about, that does open the doorway to awareness, let's say. So
it does. And I have a set of 12 paintings of the microwave radiation of Princeton University. It's Peyton Hall, and it's called The Microwave Mosaic. And it was named by an astrophysicist there. And that's where some of the most basic work has been done in the microwave, but yet they're hanging there. So, you know, you should check them out sometime. I'd be glad to show you.
I would love to come and visit you in Princeton. I mean, what is a microwave, actually?
It's just a high-frequency radiation. A radiation is just electromagnetic radiation. Is just an oscillation of energy, actually. And it's the same microwave energy which you get in the ovens and the cell phones. It's a form of heat. So we utilize the heat for ovens, and we also utilize those same oscillations for cell phones to carry information. But when the universe was hypothesized to blow up in the Big Bang about 14 billion years ago, there was this, of course, unbelievably huge explosion, which happened very, very fast, we think. And there's still the residual heat left over from that, which you can pick up with these satellites. So it's just really a high oscillation, which is a heat. It's just heat.
I mean, do you think there was really a Big Bang, or is that just another one of these fudge factors that try to explain the unexplainable?
Well, the only theory that would explain it is was put forth by a physicist at MIT named Alan Guth back in the 70s, called the inflationary universe theory. And in order to make all the theories fit that we have for physics in a consistent way, what you're forced into having is a situation where the entire universe as we know it today, being as astronomically large as it is, was actually the size of a golf ball. And that thing blew up in 1 over 10 to the 24th seconds, like an incredibly small amount of time. It went from nothing to everything. And that's the current theory. Now, no one knows if that's the case, but they're looking at this microwave background radiation of the universe to try to infer where it came from and maybe verify that theory.
Well, but that would then explain a sort of symmetry in the universe, and it doesn't seem like the universe is symmetrical, does it? I mean, aren't we moving towards a place that can't be explained? Aren't we moving towards the Virgo Nebula or something like that? Isn't there stuff like that going on?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, you're right in saying there does not. If you look at the structure of the galaxies and how they're set up, and because there's trillions of them. Or if you look at the background microwave radiation that occurred soon after the Big Bang, there does not appear to be any kind of symmetry whatsoever. That's a very strange result. And I think although the inflationary theory of the universe appears to be what cosmologists seem to accept at some level, no one really knows. I mean, no one really knows this.
Well, that's the good of you to say that no one really knows why things are, and if it's really true or if it's just the sort of story that was made up to explain things, because, yeah.
Nobody knows.
We have a question from someone in the studio. We're almost out of time, but someone wants to know about Rodin's coil. Do you know about that?
Rodin's coil? Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
But someone asked a question. Can you talk about that for just a brief?
Okay, it's funny you ask. I've been talking to someone who's actually working on that. I don't know too much about them. As far as I know, and I could be way off base here, so if I am, slap my wrist.
That's okay.
But if you take a standard toroidal coil, and you just have the white, the copper goes around it, you can buy these online.
Uh-huh.
If they're wound in a special way, by winding them in a special kind of fashion, you still get a toroidal coil. But if you, the claim is that if you put current in this, you actually get more energy out than you're putting in.
And, so you get a free energy machine, you're saying?
Yeah, that's the claim. Now, this has not been proven at all, but some people think it's true and they have claims to it, but it's never been proven. If it did, you'd know about it. I mean,
well, could it be? It would be pretty easy to just do it, though. It doesn't seem like it's that hard to try.
You would think so, and this part of it I don't know, understand. I don't think anybody has truly designed a good enough one yet that has really been tested thoroughly by the scientific community.
But what would explain it? Let's say it was true. What would explain that physics of getting more energy out than you put in?
I have no idea. This I have no idea about. The only thing I can remotely relate it to would be basically when you put energy through a coil, it's you're making a like electromagnetic field, and the electromagnetic field results from, mathematically speaking, from Maxwell's equations, and there could very well be a situation where you have like what I was talking about around the moon, where if you go on the moon at just the right way, the gravitational field's balanced, and we know now experimentally by real spacecraft that they will actually go around the moon for free. So in a sense, they've done something that intuitively you shouldn't be able to do. You go around an object without even slowing down. So you, in a sense, you're not getting energy for free, but the system is chaotically allowing you to do something that is not intuitively clear. So it could very well be that if you make a coil just the right way, that the energy that you're getting out is a little bit more than what you're putting in. It just may work out that way. Now,
well, that makes sense. I mean, it doesn't. I mean, of course, you have to know the physics, but there seems to be a lot more energy in the universe than people are aware of. I mean, in just a cube and centimeter of space, there's probably enough, energy to power the world. It seems like,
Yeah. This is that. The idea, that you have space itself is not empty. Of course, this theory is that it's filled with all this energy, but of course, if we could harness that, then all our troubles would be over, and you might have starships. But if this coil is actually working in that realm, then that would explain why it's getting that little bit of extra energy.
Well, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate, all aspects of what you're doing, your art, your science, and what I'm calling your mystical side. So,
thanks.
No, I think it's important that they all come together, because I think people like you can make a difference, and I encourage you to come forward with your experiences and try to make the scientific world make sense of it, because, the subjective reality is really, I think, the paradigm of the future. So thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and give me a call anytime. I'll show you these paintings of Princeton.
And I will send you that. I'll send you that paper by that guy, Nassim.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. I appreciate it.
And your website again is.
It's edbelbruno.com.
Ed Belbruno, EDBELBRUNO.com. Thank you, Ed, and stay in touch. I'll post this on newrealities.com. People can also find this on BBS Radio. Thanks for being a guest on New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. And if you want to reach me, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net and check my website, newrealities.com. Thanks for listening.